Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Caspar Henderson, author of a 21st century bestiary entitled The Book of Barely Imagined Beings, which is one of the most imaginatively conceived and beautifully produced books I've had the pleasure of coming across this year. In the introduction, Caspar describes how the book was inspired when he was on a riverside picnic in Oxford a few years ago. He'd been reading Borges's Book of Imaginary Beasts, and having leafed through this book, fell asleep. Then he writes, "I woke with the thought that many real animals are stranger than imaginary ones, and it's our knowledge and understanding of them that are too cramped and fragmentary to accommodate them. We have barely imagined them." And so was conceived this A to Z of weird and wonderful creatures, all of them real, and their unfamiliar ways of being in the world. And as human beings are animals that wonder about their place in the world, Caspar is also interested in how we have related to animals, from venerating them and mythologizing them, to hunting them out of existence, or inadvertently destroying their habitat as we dominate ever more of the planet. It's a book of wonders rather than one of doom and gloom, but it is one nevertheless which is aware that the clock is ticking for many species, and that our actions or inaction may bring about their end. What I'd most like to convey, though, is the sheer exuberance of Caspar's engagement with creatures which are often little known, overlooked, or sometimes disparaged. In his chapter on worms, he writes, "Every human being can benefit from contemplating the riot, the carnival, the Salmagundi of worms. And what goes for worms holds good for the whole of nature in this splendid Salmagundi of a book." I began by remarking that this bestiary, conceived on a picnic by the Charwell in Oxford, had an illustrious predecessor in another book of wonders by Lewis Carroll, which came into being in similar circumstances.
Yes, in 2007, I went for a picnic with my baby daughter and my wife in a beautiful place where there's a little weir and the water comes falling over it in the sunshine. It's gorgeous. And I'm a very kind of earnest, serious person, but on this day I had a strange book in my pack, The Book of Imaginary Beings by Jorge Luis Borges. And I was leafing through this book before I fell asleep. And when I woke up, I had the idea for the book. It's just as simple as that. It was inspired by the river and the book.
No white rabbits involved?
Not that I saw, no. A sleeping baby girl and a beautiful river and some very strange images in my head.
So tell me then what that initial conception was for the book.
Well, it was in a way very simple, but also very ambitious, which is that, and also in a sense crashingly obvious, and at least to me, which is that the real world is more extraordinary even than the extraordinary creations of the human imagination. When we're fully awake and alive to what's going on around us, we can't but be astonished. We might be appalled as well, but we can't but be astonished by everything and by the fact of our own existence. This is really where I wanted to start, that the real world, the real animals in it, ourselves, are more extraordinary than the things we tend to imagine and put into our myths and stories.
But your intention went far beyond simply wanting to write a sort of natural history, didn't it?
Yes, it did, because I have spent quite a few years as an environmental journalist and as a political journalist, and I'm one of those people who's very concerned about what's happening in the world, conflicts over resources, conflicts over political ideas, and also the fate of our natural environment, which I think is deeply, deeply concerning and getting worse in many respects. Albeit, at the same time, there are extraordinary achievements in science and culture. So we live in this sort of dual reality of amazing discoveries and deeply worrying trends. And I wanted to bring both of these into the book.
And the way you do it is by, I suppose, borrowing the conceit of a medieval bestiary.
Yes, this seemed like a wonderful place to start, because bestiaries are books of beasts from the Middle Ages. And partly they were texts designed for priests to tell their congregations about how the world was. They take animals and they tell the reader that this animal illustrates a lesson in God's plan. But they're also celebrations of life. They're full of extraordinary details, wonderful pictures, and bits and pieces of Greek and Roman learning and other perhaps Arab and Arabic learning and medieval science that do inform them. And so they're combinations of didactic moral tales and also celebrations of life and records of facts. I wanted to do something similar. I had a message I felt around the points we've just discussed of the concern about the natural world, but also to celebrate the natural world. And I think one can do both in this extraordinary form, this bestiary. And I didn't know of anybody who'd done anything like this, and it just seemed like a good idea.
In the medieval antecedents, the animals selected have this sort of quality of exemplarity, don't they? They're examples of desirable characteristics or undesirable characteristics. And you've also carried this exemplarity through, albeit not with the same sort of moral purpose.
That's true. In bestiaries, an eagle might represent noble behaviour. A worm, perhaps, you know, is vile and disgusting. And these are exemplars for human behaviour, models for us. We like to think of ourselves as children of the Enlightenment, of Hume and Darwin and J.B.S. Haldane and all the rest of it. You know, we don't believe that nature has moral lessons for us. But I think also we learn from the humanities and anthropology that humans cannot but moralise their world. And indeed, there's a way in which we are making the world into an allegory, almost like a medieval allegory, because we're reshaping it according to our own values. And some of the animals I've selected, I think they justifiably, if we look at what's happening to them, they tell us what we are like and what we're doing to ourselves.
So you selected an animal beginning with each letter of the alphabet, apart from highly perversely choosing two beginning with X. Tell me how you set about selecting. Because you don't go for the obvious ones. You don't go for elephant and lion and the ones which you might have found in a medieval bestiary.
No, well, there are a few which are maybe obvious. A dolphin, there's a wonderful passage in a medieval bestiary about dolphins. But I wanted to do several things. I wanted to learn for myself and to discover some of the extraordinary creatures. It seems sometimes there's almost, not infinite, but sort of indefinitely large number of extraordinary animals out there. And there's so many parts of the world that we don't understand, that we've barely understood, that we've barely imagined. And so I wanted to reach out to some of these in Iridigorkia and Gonodactylus and Xenophyophore. I wanted to have an ABC, although actually medieval bestiaries aren't ABCdariums. They don't have that kind of ordering. But I wanted to give it this kind of structure.
Tell me then how you actually made those difficult choices.
That was hard. There were some animals I just thought I couldn't but write about. I was so fascinated or astonished when I learnt about them. Iridigorkia is one I mentioned. There were several candidates for the different letters, and at some point I just had to say, no, I'm only going to do one, I'm choosing to do one, at least as the headline of the chapter, because each chapter does, in fact, I think every chapter has many animals in it, but is headlined by one animal. And I chose an animal that most closely related to an aspect of the central theme of the book as I saw it. That digresses and builds out in many ways into reflections on human memory and our sense of perception and time, vision, many things. And I found animals which showed us something about, for example, the nature of vision that I hadn't really thought about and I find fascinating, and I've tried to share that fascination.
I really enjoyed the fact that the sense of wonder in the book comes from knowledge. It doesn't come from wondering in ignorance. It actually comes from discovering more about these creatures. And it was very striking that often the research on which the chapter is based, it's very recent. You say sometimes this species wasn't discovered until 2005, or this phenomenon wasn't observed until 2008. So it really emphasizes how very, very recent much of our knowledge about these amazing animals is.
That's absolutely right. One of the other things I wanted to do in the book was to reflect precisely that point, and also to remind the reader that something like 9/10 of the habitable space on the planet is in the seas. It's 7/10 of the surface of the globe, but 9/10 of the habitable space, maybe more. The deep seas are less well explored in some respects, in many respects, than is the moon or some of the planets in the solar system. And it's only in very recent years that we've been discovering extraordinary creatures living down there and ways of life and indeed whole ecosystems we didn't even know about until, in some cases, a few decades ago, in some cases only a few years ago. So there's an apparent paradox, because while we're also in a time of enormous, very high rate of extinction of animals, we're also discovering lots of animals. If you can read two accounts and you can see, well, we're increasing the number of animals we know about. That must mean there are more animals in the world. At the same time, we're reading there are fewer and fewer as environments are changed and perturbed.
you go under the sea quite often, and you go for animals which might be classified as rather difficult to warm to because they're cold-blooded, or they're not the sort of panda, sort of emblematic kind of species.
You can get stuck with the kind of dichotomy between the warm, cuddly panda and the nature red in tooth and claw contrast, that paradigm, those two extremes. A lot of nature is profoundly, as well as astonishing, it's in some level profoundly disquieting. Although I would argue that you come out of the other side of that sense of disquiet with your sense of wonder enhanced when, for example, you learn about viruses and their role in human evolution. You come out thinking, wow, that is really amazing, even if I feel a little uncomfortable. But actually, I feel more human and I realize more what it is to be human than I did before. But yes, there's some very unappealing creatures in. Oh, actually, I find them fascinating. But there's a giant protist that lives on the seafloor in the abyssal plain. It looks like basically like a rotting cabbage. It's a giant single-celled organism, and it leaves a trail of mucus behind it and slime. And but it is astonishing in its own right. It's very, very ancient and I think wonderful.
Did you set any rules for yourself in terms of anthropomorphism? How much you were ready to describe animals' behaviour and characters in terms of human correlatives?
I didn't set a specific rule for myself, but I tried to be aware of when I was doing it. And I also tried to reflect what I understand to be the best thinking on this topic. And I may not have achieved that, but I've tried hard because, for example, I think if you look to ethologists, people who study animal behavior, Franz de Waal is a very good example, the primatologist, you see that animals and humans in our behavior, our emotions, are really close. We have capacities, including a very language which enables us to transmit culture in a way that perhaps no other animal can do as well. We have capacities that are unique. But we share our emotions and many of our behaviours profoundly with animals which we're used to thinking of as much more primitive than ourselves. And this is a profoundly important point in itself. We've come out of the other side of a time when, in the West at least, we made a big division between animals and humans. And now people argue there's a danger that we don't recognise the differences. But I don't think that danger is real, because we have the tools, we have the understanding, the research, the good communication to show us much more precisely what we do share and what we don't. And we do share a huge amount.
Yeah, I think it's in Philosophers and Primates by Franz de Waal. I suppose it's a warning, really. He says, you know, an excess of anthropomorphism is dangerous, but so is a deficiency of it, an entire deficiency of it. And as you say, in very recent years, we've discovered that animals like elephants have a theory of mind, which is quite astonishing, really, given the way that we've treated them for centuries.
It is. Elephants have a theory of mind. Crows are very bright. Talk to the crow people. I haven't talked about crows in this book, but my goodness, some people rate crows as more intelligent than orangutans or chimpanzees. So this is a very rich and wonderful field of research, and it's, I think it informs our moral and political stance and our sense of, you know, other things like justice and fairness. These clearly exist in some of what we call the higher animals.
But the sense of time running out is a palpable one throughout the book, and you quote at one point, I think the 25 most endangered species of apes and monkeys would fit in a single football stadium, which is a really chilling thought.
Yes, all the individuals of the 25 most endangered species, I think, of primates would fit in a single football stadium. So the humans are destroying natural habitats hand over fist, and that's tragic for the loss of the evolutionary potential, the wonderful animals, but also the evolutionary potential in those systems. This isn't a council of despair, because there is great richness remaining in which we need to celebrate all the more so that we can recruit more people into protecting it. But it is a profoundly worrying time for natural life, for animals.
You described it very tellingly, I thought, as the Anthropocene bottleneck. I think you were speculating as to whether the leatherback turtle would make it through this Anthropocene bottleneck. And I thought that was a very memorable way, really, of saying that many species are unlikely to survive, even if we radically changed our behaviour, which seems fairly unlikely.
I fear that may be right. I mean, quite a lot of animals are, you know, they're now conservation dependent, and that's great. So when you have the money and the resources and the political and cultural will to support it, but if that should erode because societies are entering times of great difficulty and conflict, then probably those animals are gone. And also, there are lots of stressors on the Earth system which we don't fully understand. one among many are some of the chemicals that we're putting into the ocean. We're loading it with tiny plastic particles. In a matter of a few decades, the oceans become full of tiny plastic particles which carry artificial human-made chemicals on their surfaces. And we don't yet know whether this is going to have a deleterious effect. And if it does, then we have a real problem. We don't yet know how serious the level of mercury that we put into the sea through the combustion of coal and through other routes. We don't yet know how serious that's going to be. So we could see some really, really bad things happen. You know, at the worst, could be, you know, we could be looking at something worse than the Permian extinction 251 million years ago. Everybody's heard of the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction, even if they don't know that name, because everybody's heard about the dinosaurs and the meteorite, it's thought, that killed them. That was the Cretaceous-Tertiary 65 million years ago. But what we're looking at could be an extinction much worse than that, the Permian 251 million years ago.
The book is also a useful reminder that past centuries haven't only been about depredation. I mean, there are terrible stories of whaling and other things in the book from the past. But there are also reminders that people have had different relationships and much closer relationships with animals going back to, you know, cave paintings 20 or 30,000 years ago. And the example of the honey badger seemed to me a particularly instructive one. And I wondered if you first of all could pronounce the name of the honey badger as it's given in the book, and then tell me what you think the story of the honey badger sort of says.
I can't pronounce the name of the honey badger as it's been recorded from the Hadza language of the Hadza people of Tanzania. I would just go with Kirifako, but it has clicks in it. Some of the world's oldest languages, so far as we know, are the languages of the Hadza people and their relations in southern Africa, what we call the bush or the sun. These are languages with many clicks, but I haven't tried to master them. The honey badger, there's a wonderful video on the web, an amusing video on the web called the Crazy Nasty Ass Honey Badger, which will give you a sense of what this animal's like. It's a real tough little customer, but it has a fascinating interaction with a bird called the honey guide, which likes to eat honey and the wax from bees' nests, but isn't strong or big enough to get it from the bees itself. So it recruits other animals into this task. It does it with the honey badger, and it's been doing it with humans probably for a very long time. And the relation between the honey badger and the honey guide, I think, is not an echo because it's earlier, but it has a parallel in the relationship between humans and the honey guide, and also humans and some other animals in our past.
And I was also very struck by the text, which was a Sufi text, an Islamic mystic text, written in 10th century Basra, which was basically a complaint brought by the animals against humankind for their treatment.
The animals' lawsuit against humanity is, as you say, a text from 10th or 11th century Basra. And it's precisely that. It's an appeal to the court of the king of the jinn. The jinn, as you know, are these parallel beings to humans, which in Islamic tradition are believed to be made of fire. The animals complain of their treatment by humans. And in the judgment of the jinn, the animals are right. Just because humans have the remarkable abilities they have gives them no right to abuse the other animals.
Now, H for human, you decided to put as, although we're in the book really throughout because it is about our relationship with the natural world, you decided to devote a chapter to us humans. Tell me how you began to think about what was going to go into that.
I'm not sure I can remember how I began. I mean, it seemed a completely impossible task, but I felt I wanted to go back to some fundamentals about being human. And for me, my experience... I wanted to explore two things which for me are very profound. Human movement, our bodies, how they move, how this has shaped what we are and how we think. And one of the manifestations of humanity, which is something that I treasure the most, and I think many people do, and that's music. So we're quite unusual in that we're bipedal animals. We go around on 2 feet, and our way of walking on 2 feet is unlike any other biped. If you think of kangaroos or dinosaurs, they didn't walk anything like humans walk. So we have this unique way of walking, which has actually, many paleoanthropologists believe, profoundly shaped our cognition. For one thing, by freeing up the hands and having a steady stance, we were able to do things, manipulate with our hands, and that in partnership with the growth of our brains, contributed to our evolution as a modern human species. As running animals, as dancing animals, we depend on having these 2 feet and having 2 arms to wave around. That's one aspect. And it just felt, I went with a hunch, I went with an emotion, in a sense, that this was very important to us and something I wanted to understand. And with music, it was, for me, there are so many questions around music and its role in our lives. You know, is it a technology? Does it have an evolutionary role? Does it give us an advantage in some ways?
Is it just a peacock's tail?
Is it just a peacock's tail, as Darwin suggested at first? And peacock's tail in the sense it's something amazing you give to show off to impress the girls or the boys. Maybe, could it be all of these things? And what does it mean to us, and why does it matter so much? And I wanted to have some fun. I mean, some people have said I've let humans off a bit lightly in that chapter, given what we can be like. But I think I found that chapter really, really a pleasure to write. And I enjoy reading it myself, actually. And I think it does say something about aspects of our being which are very important.
Casper, we talked earlier about the notion of the Anthropocene bottleneck through which only a certain proportion of species would pass. And our biologist E.O. Wilson has actually coined a term, the Eremozoic, for a future age of loneliness in which mankind is left with just a much reduced number of species. And I wondered, in conclusion, if the book is ultimately pessimistic, or do you see reason for hope persisting?
I'm 51% optimistic and 49% pessimistic. Humans are eliminating many life forms. We've been doing this for tens of thousands of years. We're also appreciating more and more, I think, how extraordinary life is. We've developed ways of protecting life and ecosystems. We understand them poorly, but better than we did, and we can understand what's necessary to protect them. We understand the scale of the pressures that natural systems are under and that humans ourselves are under. There's no guarantee we're going to get things onto a better trajectory, but there's certainly the possibility. And we're also beginning to manipulate life in extraordinary ways, both for good and bad, I think. But this could include recovering forms of life and ecosystems which have been all but eliminated that we could see in the future, perhaps the 22nd century, things getting a lot better.
Casper Henderson. The Book of Barely Imagined Beings is out now in hardback. You can find out more about it, and several million other titles besides, by going to blackwell.co.uk. There's also a podcast archive there of over 150 author interviews. Look for the podcast tab on the home page. And you can subscribe to the podcast by visiting iTunes and typing Blackwell in the search box under podcasts. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell podcast, but until we meet again, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.